Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfield, Judge Larkin, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Diane B. Bratfield presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is May 15th, 2024. We have a total of four matters on our calendar this morning. Three of those are going to be heard orally, and I see that I have here the attorneys present for the first case. So I'll ask the marshal to call the first case. I'll have just a couple of remarks before we start the argument.
Calling A23-1758 Maria Olson et al. Appellants versus Hinshaw and Culbertson LLP respondent.
All right, and I'll ask just a few things. So first of all, for the appellants, is there any sharing of time or?
No.
Okay, all right, very good. And then just to a quick few quick reminders you may well be aware of, but I just want to remind everybody. So before you begin your argument, a couple of things. Please take whatever time you need to make adjustments. The podium does go up and down, and the microphone, of course, can also be moved around. We just want to make sure we have you're comfortable, have a good conversation with us, as well as take the time to make sure that we're capturing the sound. Now, before you start your argument, speaking of sound, we make an audio recording today. It is later posted on the court's website. If you would identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you begin your argument. Also, keep an eye on the clock. That's that is visible on the podium, just 15 minutes per side, 5 minutes for the appellant at the end. And if the appellant so chooses, we very much enjoy the conversation. Keep your eye on the clock because it tends to go quickly. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Wayne Holstead, appearing on behalf of Maria Olson, Shannon Olson, and SSO LLC. At trial, when we were discussing Rule 20, I think we all understood, including Judge Wall, that whichever way he ruled, we would be coming up here. We didn't have a lot of chance at the time to really research the rule, and so the judge did the best he could, and we did the best we could arguing it. But I think having now read the rule 100 times or more since the trial, it's clear to me Rule 20 is for the benefit of the lawyers' board. It should not be invoked for the benefit of the attorneys, because what we end up having here is basically a cover-up. I don't think that's really what Rule 20 was supposed to be for.
Counsel, if you don't mind, and I want to give you whatever time you need for your argument, but you've started with Rule 20, which is, as you said, you know, an interesting legal question, one that we haven't faced before and so don't have law on it. I just want to make sure I understand how Rule 20 supports your claim that you're entitled to a new trial. So which piece of evidence would you have us first focus our attention on?
There's a letter which I've referred to as the Jimmy Lindbergh letter, and we've also referred to it as the smoking gun document.
Okay.
It's a letter. Jimmy Lindbergh was the attorney for the title company.
So well, before you go too far into the facts, because I thank you so much for the briefs. We've read the briefs, and we're familiar with the facts. The smoking gun documents, as I read the argument by respondent's counsel, they suggest that those were essentially submitted by stipulation. And so if the documents themselves were received into evidence, I'm a little unclear as to how that would entitle you to
the importance
new
of the documents isn't just limited to the documents themselves. It's how she got them.
So they were, though, received into evidence. You agree with that?
But we weren't able to really testify as to how she received it. And it was the linchpin of our case.
So you're talking, again, about the source of those smoking gun documents?
That she was given those documents by Kevin Slater, the investigator. Because what she was left with after the ruling is she couldn't testify to that. She had to say that she found the documents. Well, you could almost hear the jury's eyes roll when we said that. I mean, it just wasn't credible, and it just doesn't tell the story. The documents in their file had to be uncovered by the investigator.
So help me understand that. I mean, I saw that in your briefing. I'm not connecting the dots between the source of the smoking gun documents and, for instance, the jury's answers on the special verdict form, right? And the theories that the jury was presented with. What is the relevance of the source of the documents to your theories for relief?
Yeah, and I have 30-plus years of title experience resolving title issues. So what hit me immediately when I saw that letter from Jimmy Lindbergh, which was prior to the closing in the documents that the Olsons were accused of committing fraud, the bank was aware that the easements that they said the Olsons fraudulently failed to give, the bank was made aware by their title company lawyer, you need to get these easements in the documents. The bank's representatives drafted the documents. They didn't put these easements in, and then they turned around and accused them of fraud. And that was the devastating part. I mean, they didn't even have to do that. And as a title lawyer...
So again, help me out. I do understand those facts and that you've alleged them and presented evidence at trial about them. I'm still not connecting it with your specific causes of action that were presented to the jury, and I'm probably just missing something. So I understand that you're, for instance, alleging a breach of fiduciary duty on the part of the Hinshaw firm for representing Mora Bank and preparing this complaint. But how is that connected to the smoking gun documents, and particularly the source of the smoking gun documents? That's what I don't understand.
If I had been representing the Olsons at the time of the 47 lawsuit, and during the settlement discussions, the bank was going after them for a considerable amount of money. If I had those documents, it would have been summary judgment in my favor because the bank was accusing them of fraud. They were trying to reform the documents on the basis of fraud. There was no fraud. And the fact that the bank was notified by this letter proves that beyond any doubt. So there was no case. But the lawsuit was used to force the settlement to get them to forfeit all their rights that they had obtained by selling the property to the purchaser, who was then in default. So these documents are, they're actually the basis for the case.
So it sounds to me like you're focusing on this breach of fiduciary duty, which I appreciate. I suggested that in my question. So the jury found that Hinshaw did not owe plaintiffs a fiduciary duty under the rules of professional conduct. I mean, that is a finding in the special verdict, and it's one that's not challenged on the appeal, or at least I'm not seeing how it's challenged. So help me understand how you get around that determination and get a new trial.
What the jury didn't get to hear, and this is a second argument, which is really the Ralph Warden documents, the fiduciary duty is owed under the rules. I think it's 1.19 is what Dr. Cooperstein was relying on. I'm not absolutely sure of that. But what the board in their investigation and what we had to prove is that the representation in 2010, which is not denied, was substantially related, and those are key words, substantially related to the 2013 representation. Now, Dr. Cooperstein, I happened to watch both his CLE videos, on-demand videos. He states, if the same attorney is involved in both representations, it's substantially related. It's not an issue. It's not an issue for the jury. We couldn't get that evidence in, and we should. And that's
that evidence? I'm sorry.
We call them the discovery documents, but actually, it's one email. There's one email that has Ralph Warden's name on it. It's in October of 2013, a month before the lawsuit was brought, where Ralph Warden is telling the trial attorney he was suggesting that there was fraud. And that was actually based on there were two parcels originally sold in 2010. He was referring to the parcel that he'd actually worked on it. They were accusing the Olsons of fraud for not including easements in the documents, and yet Ralph Warden was the attorney that eliminated the easements when he was doing the legal work for the Olsons, which then at trial they said, but Ralph Warden never talked to the Olsons. So basically he removed the easements without telling them and then said, let's sue him for fraud for not including the easements. Okay. So the jury, at a minimum, if we could have told that to the jury, if we could have cross-examined Dr. Cooperstein,
Well, you did have the opportunity to cross-examine Dr. Cooperstein.
We were not allowed to bring it up.
Bring what up?
The Ralph Warden document.
Okay.
And I checked the record, you know, prior to the appeal to make sure we were simply not permitted to talk about any of the what they call the Slater documents, which was the board's documents.
That gets me back to our earlier exchange. I mean, in fact, the smoking gun documents did go in. Slater would have been called to lay foundation for those.
We did call him.
But the party stipulated, right? I mean, that's the argument I see in respondent's brief. I didn't see a response from you. It seems as though you're acknowledging that the smoking gun documents were received into evidence.
So. But we weren't allowed to say that she got the documents. And I can't overemphasize enough, although I probably will in the court's eyes, the fact that she got them the way she got them as opposed to just finding them. I mean, it just, the inability to say that was devastating to our case.
Well, and if you don't mind explaining that one more time to me, how does that prove your claim in this case, the source of those documents? I apologize, but I'm not catching.
Well, the source was in the Hinshaw's files. These are documents discovered in Hinshaw's files by the investigator. And the document themselves prove that the complaint that they drafted was a lie. I mean, they knew there was no fraud. And they didn't even have to allege fraud, but they did.
And that's not evident on the face of the documents.
No, what's evident on the face of the document is that Mora Bank was told you need to get easements. There are no easements across Lot 2 for the benefit of the property that they had a mortgage on. That's not a difficult thing to do. And call the title company and say, would you have the easement? Jimmy Lindbergh, the title company lawyer, said you need to do that. They didn't do it because what we're alleging and attempting to prove is they had an ulterior motive. But getting back to the document itself, the document proves that the 47 lawsuit was not true. The allegations were not true,
where,
and they knew.
Where did, in the record, did you preserve that particular objection? The desire, because obviously the smoking gun documents got into evidence through this stipulation, right? So it fell to the plaintiffs to articulate on the record, then, the need to prove the source of those smoking gun documents. Because as I see the district court's ruling, there was an acquiescence on the part of the Olsons and their attorneys to use the stipulation in lieu of, and I think that is the record language, in lieu of the testimony of Slater.
The stipulation was before the Rule 20 ruling. And so the Rule 20
ruling. I just am not convinced we need to go to the Rule 20 ruling. If you don't preserve the error, then I don't see why
the inability to explain where she got the documents is what our case is based on. And
where do you think that error was preserved? In the record before the district court after the stipulated exhibits were received?
I can't tell you exactly where in the record that
is. Well, even if you could describe it. Where was that objection preserved?
You know, reading through the transcripts, as I just did a couple days ago again, I recalled how confused everything was. We were talking about multiple documents, multiple issues. Everything was raised, but raised in the manner in which the court is suggesting it should have been done. I don't think it was ever that clear because we were really bouncing around on so many topics at the time. Mm-hmm. But when the documents were stipulated to, it was for the purpose of excusing Kevin Slater, which personally I would have preferred to have him stay because he was. And it does go to a different part of Rule 20. I mean, Rule 20 doesn't say that he couldn't testify. It says he could say he didn't want to, but the court could overrule that. He came voluntarily and was willing and wanted to testify, but we decided, we stipulated that if he's testifying the foundation, if we stipulated that he could go. But then it was later that Rule 20 was brought up, where at that point, all the documents we stipulated we could enter them, but couldn't explain where they came from.
Could I, if I may? Counsel, in addition to the preservation issue, I mean, because you started out with Rule 20 and how central that was, but, and you're, and as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the Rule 20 issue really came up during trial, as you said, right?
Yes.
But in addition to the court relying on Rule 20 in the post-trial motion, the motions for ruling on the motion for a new trial, also the judge also referred back to the motion in limine decisions, which didn't go to Rule 20, but talked about, but addressed the motion to exclude the documents related to the lawyer's board. And, you know, and there the court talked about, you know, the different legal and evidentiary standards and as being a basis, right, for not, for excluding potentially those documents and the testimony from the lawyer's board, right? And which is before you get to Rule 20. So weren't there really two bases for the court's decision if, you know, assuming the it's preserved?
As I recall the discussion and the ruling on the motion in limine, Judge Wall's concern was with foundation. Could we bring, did we have a witness who could provide the foundation to get them admitted? It was at that point that we brought in Kevin Slater for foundation purposes. So I think we satisfied the judge's concerns on the motion in limine. Rule 20 issue went beyond that, and it was a new issue. It would have been nice had that issue come up in the motion in limine so we could have researched a little bit, including for the judge's benefit, because we really struggled at trial looking at the rule, trying to figure out what it meant. And the judge interpreted it as restrictively as it could be interpreted. And I think as a precedent, and this goes beyond the interests of our clients here, obviously we're taking two different sides, but is the rule correctly interpreted by Judge Wall that it's basically used to consider everything privileged and can't be used? I don't read the rule that way. I'm out of time, I see.
Oh, no, counsel, please finish your answer if you'd like. Don't worry about the time.
I think I did.
Was there more?
I kind
okay.
of
all right.
Forgot
all right.
where
and
I was already.
Of course, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
So. Okay.
All right. Thanks
thank
so much.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Louise Barrent, and I'm here today representing respondent Hinshaw and Culbertson. As I'm hearing Mr. Holstad's arguments today, that actually dovetails with what I initially was going to start with, which is that for an appeal that's primarily about evidentiary issues and what was done at trial, the appellant's briefs are pretty much devoid of reference to the record. That's why Hinshaw took great pains in the respondent's brief to cite to relevant portions of the record, including relevant portions of the trial transcript. And as a broad overarching argument, Hinshaw's position here today is that the record in this matter, the transcript and all of the exhibits and the pretrial orders that came before it, show without any doubt that all of the evidentiary issues that were presented to the Hennepin County District Court for determination were well-founded on the law, and the appellants herein have not shown in any way, shape, or form that there was any abuse of that discretion. Counsel here today started out with Rule 20, and Hinshaw's position is that Rule 20 is frankly a red herring. Hinshaw acknowledged in the respondent's brief that Rule 20 was brought up for the first time on the first day of trial with respect to the issue of Kevin Slater only. The recitation of the facts in the respondent's brief goes through that probably in a little bit too excruciating detail, but between, I believe it's pages 6 through 38 of record 146, which is the transcript of May 3rd, there's a specific and detailed discussion about Rule 20, Kevin Slater, and what he was going to testify to. That portion of the record clearly shows that Rule 20 was only brought up with respect to the appellant's desire to call Mr. Slater as a witness to provide foundation for the smoking gun documents.
And do you agree with appellant counsel's characterization of that foundation? It's not to identify, for instance, the author of the document, but to identify the source of the smoking gun documents that they were found in the Hinshaw files.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's an interesting question. I think that that's really two issues. The discussion on pages 6 through 38 of Record 146 shows that the desire of the appellants was to get the smoking gun documents into the record, and as the court has recognized, those were stipulated for admission in a new document entitled Exhibit 161 that included Exhibits 11 and 12. That included the Jimmy Lindbergh letter, the 2009 letter, and some emails from an individual named Vanden Heuvel, who was the president of
the
bank.
Right, and we do have those facts, but if you don't mind, to go back, did that stipulation identify for the jury that the smoking gun documents were found in Hinshaw files?
That is a good question, Your Honor, and that is Exhibit 148. That was part of 161, and I'm sorry for all of the numbers, but when Hinshaw and Culbertson agreed to the stipulated admission of 11 and 12, mindful of the fact that with respect to the smoking gun documents, the court was looking for foundation tying the documents to Hinshaw. So Hinshaw said, let's put in Exhibit 148. Exhibit 148, part of 161, was an email written by Ralph Warden in November of 2013. And I believe that email explains that the other two documents, the Jimmy Lindbergh letter and the Vanden Heuvel email, were in Hinshaw's files. It's Hinshaw's position that those three things gave the appellants what they needed. What I'm hearing here today and what I saw in the appellant's reply brief was that, well, that was useless because we couldn't have Maria Olson testify to the fact that it was Kevin Slater who found the warden email and the two attached documents. So they were trying to say, bring back, in my estimation, the lawyer's board involvement. I went back and I looked at the record, specifically with respect to that first day, that May 3rd discussion on the record, pages 6 through 38, if that was the key, if that was the linchpin, we don't just want the smoking gun documents. We don't just want Exhibit 148, the email from Ralph Warden, but we also want Maria Olson to be able to testify that those documents came to her from Kevin Slater. That argument, that position, appears nowhere in the record. Hinshaw takes the position that's a new argument that they're raising here today that was not an argument that they originally pressed in the opening brief and was not an argument that they raised to the court on May 3rd.
So, counsel, if you could turn your attention to the district court's in limine ruling on the OLPR documents. I think it seems, and I just want to check my understanding of the record. So it's that the district court in the in limine ruling did not rely on Rule 20.
Correct.
That is something that occurred during trial.
Correct.
And instead focused on, as Judge Jessen characterized in her earlier question, the difference in standards between an OLPR
Correct.
Decision or an ethics investigation and, for instance, the claims that the Olsons are making,
Correct.
Were making against Hinshaw in this case. Is that
Correct.
Correct?
Absolutely correct.
And what do you think is your best case law to support that position, legal position,
the
difference in standards
The
matters.
Difference in standards, we yeah. cited two cases that were out of this court, albeit unpublished. There was the resident agency court and the, I think it's Nathy versus Roback case out of this court. But we also cited...
And explain that for me. So what do you think those cases...
Those two cases talk about the different evidentiary standards attendant to administrative proceedings. And particularly the Nathy case talks about that.
So, and of course, that's certainly true as a matter of fact. There are different standards between administrative proceedings and, for instance, many civil liability proceedings, but that doesn't necessarily eliminate the evidence or the relevance of the evidence. So is there any case law you can direct me to that would suggest that the evidence isn't relevant? I'm thinking particularly about the breach of fiduciary duty claim that was presented by the Olsons in this case. It seems to me that there might be some relevance to the evidence.
Right. The OLPR documents that Hinshaw sought to exclude via the motion in limine and the order that the judge granted via the motion in limine was with respect to the documents that were generated by the OPLR and I think it's the DEC, the District Ethics Committee. It's my understanding, I'm happy to say, I personally have no involvement or knowledge of how this works, but I understand that the first stop on the bus is perhaps with respect to a county committee with an ethics charge. So there was a DEC decision, and I think they, being the appellants, really wanted to get that into the record. And they also wanted, and I think it was an exhibit that they put on their list, the final decision of the OLPR, the director. Those were the materials that formed the core of the OLPR documents. With respect to your question about the foundational documents, I guess maybe that's an inappropriate choice of words. But for example, the fact that Exhibit 148, again part of 161, was in the record, that was an email from Ralph Warden saying that Hinshaw had those two smoking gun documents in its file. Those documents were in the record. The plaintiff appellants could do with those whatever they so desired at trial. But as Hinshaw argued in its brief, the appellants never used any part of 161. And that brings into the discussion the comments that Mr. Holstead just made about the alleged inability to question our expert, Mr. Cooperstein, with respect to Warden emails. As far as I can tell, and we argue this extensively in our brief, I think what they're really talking about here with what we were prevented or precluded from cross-examining Mr. Cooperstein with respect to the Rolf Warden email, the record, and I'm very familiar with it, suggests that that document was Exhibit 156. There was an extensive discussion about that on the record. I think the first part of the appellant's argument was that plaintiff's counsel could somehow provide foundation for that. The court disagreed, but there was extensive discussion about the record on the record about the appellants being able to use Exhibit 156 to cross-examine Mr. Cooperstein. That's in the record. We've cited the pages. It's in there. The appellants were not prevented from asking Mr. Cooperstein about Exhibit 156. That is the October 2013 email that they claim establishes that Hinshaw was thinking about fraud or something like that. The point being, however, for evidentiary purposes and for the purposes of this appeal, the record clearly, unequivocally, and without any doubt shows that the Hennepin County District Court allowed the appellants the opportunity to use Exhibit 156 in the cross-examination of Mr. Cooperstein, and they did not.
Did you want to finish your thought? I was going to ask you about a different issue.
No, I think I'm done with that.
Okay, so on a fraudulent concealment claim that was dismissed on the motion for summary judgment, I'd like to ask you the legal basis for the summary judgment. It's that they were not actionable representations. I understand that. What's your best case law supporting the district court's decision in that regard?
Well, the district court in its order, and it did, to a certain extent, rely, if you want to call it that, on the opinion of the Isanti County District Court in somewhat the companion case.
That's the Mora Bank.
The Mora Bank case.
Because Mora Bank was sued, or I don't know right, how did it exactly happen, but a lot of lawsuits flying there. But there was an issue about the complaint and the whether those representations in the complaint were false as to Mora Bank. Is that correct?
Yeah, okay. That is correct. There was a separate series of lawsuits, and I think an appeal before this court.
You're not arguing collateral estoppel.
No. We never argued collateral estoppel. No.
So I guess I'm not quite understanding why the district court's decision in the Moribank case, which I understand was affirmed, how that impacts this question of the summary judgment dismissal, the fraudulent
concealment. And I agree, it's confusing, Your Honor. But as I understand it, and I actually looked at that earlier appeal today, the issue in that case, as it has been sort of amorphously throughout the entire litigation against Hinshaw, is that the appellants claim that they, quote-unquote, settled the 47 lawsuit, the one that Hinshaw drafted, sometime in 2015, and then they found out documents later to establish that they're relying. I can't even articulate what the claim is because I don't frankly understand it. The claim against the Mora Bank, they sought to undo a settlement with the Mora Bank, the plaintiffs, on the basis of fraud based on the allegations in the 47 complaint. So that's the tie-in to this case. Because the allegation as to Hinshaw is that, because its only involvement in the 47 lawsuit was drafting the complaint. The fraudulent concealment claim is based solely on the allegations in the complaint. The fraud claim,
the Moribank case,
same complaint. So that's essentially, I think, the basis of the court's decision.
And it's helpful. Thank you for the factual explanation. But what I'm trying to understand is the legal basis. So, those are not actionable representations because it seems to me we don't have any case law directly on point. The district court certainly didn't.
No, we do not. And I looked back at that, Your Honor, and the district court did cite a couple of things. The district court cited a case called Kennedy versus Flowtronics, 143 Northwest 2nd, 827. And that was a case involving the alleged misrepresentation of the future value of stock. But among other things...
So that's an opinion of a future event, which we know is not an actual misrepresentation.
I'm not finished with what I was going to say.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
The issue was it was not under the circumstances a representation of facts susceptible of knowledge and could not be understood as anything other than an opinion and did not give rise to an actionable claim. That was what the district court cited in his opinion with respect to the fraudulent concealment claim.
And so how do you connect that to the district court's reasoning for dismissing the fraudulent concealment claim here?
The ultimate determination of the district court, as I understand it, was that if the fraud is based solely on allegations in the 47 complaint, allegations which the Olsons in their answer denied, allegations which in litigation are, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Can I have a few minutes to continue? Okay. The allegations in the complaint could not be construed as misrepresentations of a material fact inducing reliance because they were allegations in a complaint, allegations that the Olsons denied. That is my understanding of the basis of the district court's decision on the fraudulent concealment claim.
So on that point, it sounds like you're agreeing that we don't have a precedential case in Minnesota that says the allegations in a complaint.
We do not.
Just want to be clear. So should we be issuing a precedential decision on that basis? Because I'm sitting here also looking at the
possibly.
District court's decision.
Possibly would be helpful. Believe me, Your Honor, I think if there was a precedential opinion, I would like to think I would have found it. Thank you.
And thank you for your patience, Your Honors. Couple things. In the order regarding the motion to dismiss on the judicial action privilege and the fraudulent concealment, I think it's paragraphs 31 and 32 and 38 and 39 where Judge Wall brilliantly resolved the issue. The problem I have is he seemed to forget all that in the summary judgment, which is where I got that followed through language. And what he's on this accusations or allegations aren't representations. That's judicial action privilege. I mean, he's actually going back to not using the judicial action privilege where he should have, and he did it wrong. because there's an exception in the judicial action privilege for fraud or intentional misconduct. So that's why the count one should not have been dismissed, because Judge Wall got it right the first time. Another thing I'd like to address, the tone from the respondents all along has been, you know, what's our problem? We could have got everything in. I need to make it clear that Judge Wall made it clear that we could not go close to mentioning the lawyer's board. In the opening statement, Mr. Canuck, who handled the opening statement, may or may not have made reference to the board. We actually think he did. But there was a curative instruction of the jury afterwards that we were supposed to ignore. They were supposed to ignore any reference to the board, except for the fact that the board said they didn't do anything wrong. How harmful is that to an attorney malpractice case? But that's not what the board said. Especially in the district ethics committee report, it was 18-0 that Hinshaw did something wrong. The board, in their final...
But if I may, did you object on the record to the curative language the court used?
And that's a little muddled, which is why I haven't made a big deal about it. The court believes we stipulated to it. Our recollection is Mr. Canuck said, we want, if you're going to put that in, we want the whole opinion. The judge gave the instruction the way he gave it. But because that's so confusing,
So it's not clear from your perspective.
It's not clear. The one other point I want to make is there's a lot of lack of precedence on how to interpret Rule 20. And I only cited two cases because I can only find two. But the Kathleen Morris case, I think, is very helpful. That case says you can't use it for collateral estoppel or res judicata, which I made clear from the beginning of the lawsuit we weren't doing that. But it does seem to indicate it's very relevant. And what the court said in the Morris case is you can bring the evidence in, and then the defendant can object to it all they want. I think we should have been able to bring in the district committee's report, the whole board decision. I think they would have been very helpful to the jury. They were certainly very proud of. So I'm focusing and probably circling back to my original point. Is this case really revolves around Judge Wall's interpretation of Rule 20? And I understand his interpretation. I just think he needs guidance. We all need guidance as attorneys. How is Rule 20 supposed to be interpreted? Is it completely exclusionary? Because exception number 6, the court could overrule any part of the general rule of Rule 20. Judge Wall decided not to because he didn't think he could. I think this court needs to clarify, as our case is sent back to district court, hopefully, that Rule 20 doesn't say that. It's for the protection of the board. Kevin Slater did not object to coming to testify. The documents were already in the public domain, so they certainly couldn't be considered confidential. So I think Rule 20 was applied incorrectly, and we should have been able to try the case that we needed to and intended to. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. Very much appreciated hearing from you today, and it helps the court's decision making. The matter is now submitted to this court for a decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.